Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Good morning. I'm Ned Kalonge with the Colorado Trust. I'm pleased to be here today. You know, we're pursuing a vision of health equity in Colorado, and our community partnership strategies involves working in very small communities in our state. We're actually working in three communities in the San Luis Valley in the southern part of the state. And what's interesting is that in each community, at a very organic level, the residents have identified water as a key issue around equity. If you think about it, these are all agricultural communities, and water drives the economy. And as such, water drives power and inequities and needs to be addressed as we try to look at the health of our rural communities overall. Because of this, I'm really excited that I have the opportunity to introduce this session and introduce our next speaker. Wade Crowfoot is CEO of the Water Foundation, a strategic philanthropic organization that's focused on transforming water use in California and the American West, working collaboratively to secure the long-term availability of water for cities, farms, and the environment. He brings more than 20 years of public policy, governmental, and environmental experience and leadership to this role, with expertise in water, climate, energy policy, and sustainability issues. Wade came to the Water Foundation from California Governor Jerry Brown's administration, where he most recently served as the Deputy Cabinet Secretary and Senior Advisor to the Governor, leading the state's efforts in drought response. He holds a Master's in Public Policy from the London School of Economics and a Bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The Water Foundation launched as the California Water Foundation in 2011, but earlier this year, they transitioned to an independent, standalone foundation and have expanded their focus across the West, recognizing that waterways cross political boundaries and Western communities and natural places face similar issues. Respecting the unique character of different places in the region, they tailor lessons learned from their California work to challenges across the entire West. So with that, I'd like you to please join me in welcoming to the stage, Wade Crowfoot.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity to share some time with you here today, and thanks, Ned, for that generous introduction. I have to say I'm somewhat in awe of GIH and how well organized this conference is. I can say that this is the first time I've ever presented with walk-up music. And in case you're wondering, not only do they provide walk-up music, but you can choose your song. And true story, it's pretty neat. And my wife's a big Rolling Stones fan, so I'm excited to brag to her that not only am I important enough to have a theme song, but I chose music that she likes. So Ned summarized the Water Foundation pretty well. We're focused in the West. We're really focused on helping both communities and natural places thrive amidst an uncertain water future. But relevant to today's conversation, we in the Water Foundation and our partners in the West really understand that partnerships are needed nationally to address water. A lot of the conversations that I'm involved in on water tend to be through the environmental lens. And this is true in the West, and I think it's true in a lot of philanthropy, regardless of where it's at, that's focused on water. And that focus is for good reason. No doubt that the rivers and water systems in our country need to be healthy to keep the places that we consider sacred, our natural places, in good health, and of course, the animals that depend on them. In a place like California, we've lost 95% of the wetlands that sustain natural life over 150 years of development. So this philanthropy is important. But I'm involved in less conversations that are talking about water and people. And this is really what we're going to focus on here today. It goes without saying that water is elemental to survival and to health. Air, water, food, shelter, those are the building blocks of survival. When we have clean and healthy water to drink, to prepare our food, to bathe with for our sanitation, that's a good start to a healthy life. When water is not clean and not healthy, sickness develops, disease can develop. When clean water is not available, it drives people to unhealthy choices, including excessive use of sugary beverages. Water is obviously a critical, central part of human health. Now, the country had a wake-up call a couple of years ago with the tragic case of Flint, Michigan. And I'm confident that everybody in the room remembers and knows what happened in Flint. But let me just paint the situation in broad strokes for those who may have forgotten the details. Flint, Michigan, city of about 90,000 people, poor, largely African American, under great fiscal duress and actually state receivership, changed out its water source to save money, and in the process introduced chemicals into its water distribution system that actually corroded the very old pipes, releasing lead into Flint homes. Almost immediately, residents started complaining, discolored water, foul-smelling water, symptoms like rashes, nausea, and were largely ignored by local authorities and state authorities. And it wasn't until the persistence of local residents, a courageous local pediatrician, and actually external researchers from West Virginia University that it was conclusively demonstrated that actually lead was poisoning the water in Flint. Lead, as you know, has remarkably damaging impact on cognitive development, particularly in kids. So Flint actually experienced a horrific situation where essentially it was providing poisoned water to its residents, charging them for it, and then denying its existence when it was raised. As a result of a lot of media attention, change came. The president declared a federal emergency, congressional hearings were held, resources were provided to Flint to replace its lead lines while emergency water was provided. It's important to note, though, that those lines are still not replaced in the city of Flint. But I think what's less known about Flint is it is truly the canary in the coal mine. If you look at this map, the problem of drinking water in our country is not a dot on the map. It is the entire map. This map shows counties that have water agencies that recently violated the federal lead and copper rule, which means they either demonstrated excessive levels of lead and copper in the water or failed to test or report the testing of lead and copper levels. And what's remarkable about this, of course, is it's virtually in every state and throughout the country. This problem, though, manifests differently in different places. And I'm not going to stand up here and say every red unit on this map represents a situation exactly like Flint. It evolves differently in different places. And I want to spend a little bit of time taking you on a tour of what this can look like. I should mention before that, though, another way to break up the data is actually looking at all of the health-based violations, not only in lead and copper, but things like nitrates, pathogens, bacteria, et cetera. And in the last full year of recorded data for all the health-based violations collected by the US EPA, the number totals 27 million Americans that are served by a water system with health violations in one of these dangerous compounds. 27 million, one in 12 Americans. Now, if you count those systems that also received a violation, not because there was an excessive level of a dangerous compound in their water, but they failed to report or underreported, that number goes to 77 million people live in water systems in the country or get their water from water systems in the country with violations, either health-based or reporting. One in five Americans. And so one of the key takeaways in my education on this is far from an exception to the rule, drinking water challenges in this country are, in essence, the norm. So what does this look like in different places? This is a little guy named Adam Walton, and his picture is taken when he's 2 years old. He lives in a town in central Texas called Ranger, Texas, 2,500 people. He spent the first year of his life drinking water that had lead in excess of 28 times the federal limit. Now, I talked about the cognitive impact for kids and lead on your brain development. Remarkably, his family found out about the lead levels in his water, not from a local official, but from a USA Today reporter who was conducting an investigative piece on lead contamination in rural America. And it turns out that residents in Ranger, Texas had actually been consuming high levels of lead for some time. And that same USA Today investigative story, which you could, you know, Google today, identified 850 very small water systems with a history of lead-based contamination that had not tested their water in the 5 years preceding that newspaper story. So Ranger, Texas, again, not the exception to the norm, but arguably common in rural America. The story is also told in Toledo, Ohio, on a different water quality issue. You may have remembered in 2014, toxic algae bloom that gained national attention. Toledo, Ohio, and other communities in Northeast Ohio get their water from Lake Erie. And agricultural fertilizer runoff into Lake Erie creates essentially excessive nutrients that develop these algae blooms. The algae blooms are really bad for the lake and its environment because they starve off oxygen. But in certain conditions, particularly when it's warm, they can develop into toxic algae. So 500,000 people in Toledo and its surrounding area actually lost their water source for a period of time during this toxic algae. This is so common in the state of Ohio that the state has set up a website that it updates daily on algae conditions and whether algae conditions are toxic in several bodies of water in Ohio. And lest you think that algae is an issue limited to that state, states across the country deal with this, including my home state of California. The story is also told in small towns like Security and Wakefield, Colorado, that depend on groundwater. Security has a small town, I think about 10,000 people in southern Colorado, always depended on groundwater, and ultimately learned that its groundwater had been contaminated from industrial contaminants on a nearby Air Force base. And what was actually happening was the foam used in firefighting had leached into the groundwater, and there was an excessive existence of perfluorinated compounds, PCBs. In essence, Security Colorado lost its water source and did not have a backup water source and had to depend on emergency water for some time. And then the story is also told in places like Charleston, West Virginia. 300,000 people in the state capital of West Virginia lost their drinking water, all drinking water for 9 days, when 5,000 gallons of industrial chemicals that are used in coal processing leached from a storage tank about 2.5 miles upriver on the Elk River, and ultimately an emergency situation in Charleston. So these problems manifest differently. Some involve contamination of source water in a place like Toledo or a place like Security, Colorado. Others involve contamination within the distribution system, lead lines in Flint, Michigan, and small places like Ranger, Texas. The contamination is diverse from lead and copper, nitrates, pathogens like Cryptosporidium and Giardia, bacteria, even overflow from sewers and wastewater systems. But the fact is, this is a national problem, and it's a national health problem that not enough people are aware of. And not surprisingly to people in this room, it impacts poor communities in disproportionate ways. I showed you that map with the big number, 27 million people. Those are people that are impacted by or live in water systems with health violations. Over half of those are water systems in poor, isolated, rural areas. And I think I'd venture a guess to say the vast majority of us in this room live in communities, maybe fairly affluent communities, where we take our drinking water for granted. How many of you woke up in your hotel this morning and turned on the tap to get a drink of water and really asked yourself a question whether the water was clean? I certainly didn't. But the fact is that a whole lot of people in this country, poor folks and also disproportionately people of color, actually have to ask that question. Or if they're not asking that question, frankly, they should be asking that question. The health impacts are well documented, and many of you in this room know them better than me, whether it's nitrates and the impact it has on so-called blue baby syndrome, or Cryptosporidium and Giardia, which can do everything from generate temporary sickness to actually, for those immune system compromised folks, actually be life-threatening. So in all of these cases, the nexus or the connection between unclean water and health is really clear. And it's the people that have the least resources that are the most vulnerable. The last place I want to take you to and really move towards this discussion about solutions is, again, my home state of California. The last 5 years, of course, in California on water were largely about our drought, the worst drought in recorded history, where we were concerned with actually cities running out of water. And not surprisingly, that drought impacted poor communities of color disproportionately. The town of East Porterville is an excellent example of this situation. East Porterville is in the Central Valley. A lot of the food that you eat at certain times of the year comes from the Central Valley. It's a community in Tulare County, unincorporated, mostly comprised of poor farm workers. And all of these folks have relied on domestic wells. So this is the well in the backyard that actually brings up the water. Well, the dynamic in the Central Valley is there is depletion of the underground water basins as unsustainable pumping has occurred over time. There hasn't been good management of groundwater resources. And so what happened in the drought is a lot of that agriculture that upholds the economy there had less and less surface water from rivers and snowpack and started intensifying its pumping of groundwater. Well, the citizens of East Porterville, not surprisingly, had the shallowest wells. And when the water went down, they literally ran out of water. That is, you turn on the tap to get a drink of water, to bathe your kid, and nothing comes out. And that problem persisted for 2 years. And East Porterville was only one of several, actually scores, of communities around California that literally ran out of water. Now, the remarkable thing about this situation, it is directly adjacent to Porterville, which is an incorporated city, higher socioeconomic status, literally separated by tracks, train tracks, the proverbial and literal other side of the tracks. So East Porterville was an example of poor communities impacted by the drought. And while this was in California, you can imagine droughts happening in the West and even places like the Southeast that can impact poor communities. But the much more pervasive problem in California is actually not on water quantity or water availability, but water quality. And this is a woman named Maria Jimenez with her grandson in a place called Monson, California. And Monson, California relies on groundwater, and it's still pumping groundwater, and that groundwater comes out in Ms. Jimenez's tap. The problem is that groundwater is dangerous, and that tap water is dangerous. And you can't actually use the tap water in her home. You can't drink with it, you can't bathe with it. And so this woman, who's on a limited income, relies on the bottles of water that you see in the foreground. Monson, California is, again, not an isolated example. This is a map produced by the state agency that regulates water agencies, and each one of those red stars represents a water agency that does not have the financial and technical capacity to provide clean water to its residents. In other words, its water is contaminated, and the residents in communities with those red stars literally have to rely on bottled water. The United Nations actually assessed the situation in 2011, and I don't know what was the impetus, but ultimately found concern around the racial disparities of this distribution. These are typically poor Latino communities in agricultural regions, and the pollution that has contaminated their groundwater is based from agriculture. Now, lest you think that there's a dangerous pesticide that can just be banned, the agricultural compound that's contaminating these groundwater basins is nitrates from nitrogen. I use nitrogen fertilizer in my backyard. It's essentially a common elemental part of fertilizer, but when it aggregates and gets into groundwater systems, it becomes dangerous. And so in 2012, California took a remarkable step and declared as a state law water as a human right. The problem is that that is essentially aspirational at this point. And this map, which is literally from 3 months ago, demonstrates the ongoing problem in California. Now, I should mention, what's actually amazing about the situation in California, and I think it holds true for the country, is that very few Californians actually understand this is a problem. The majority of California's population lives in the urban coast, and even those folks that live in places like Fresno or Stockton or Sacramento in that agricultural Central Valley are on large public water systems that have clean water. We conducted a big statewide poll early this year, found 1 in 5 Californians are even aware that this is an issue. And I would venture a guess when I showed you that map with the red all over the country, if you did that similar poll in all of those states, you'd get similar results. The opportunity is that Americans get it, that contaminated water is a huge health problem. This is the Kaiser Family Foundation tracking poll data from 2016. It listed 10 health threats and asked poll respondents to essentially indicate how concerned they were or how serious that threat was. And believe it or not, contaminated water actually came in third after cancer and heroin abuse. So there's a disconnect. Not a lot of folks know that contaminated water is an issue in their state or even close to where they live, but they recognize that contaminated water, where it exists, is a big concern. So what are we doing about it? As Ned mentioned, the Water Foundation is a new organization, fairly new organization. We're really building off the long-term investments of groups in California like the California Endowment, the California Wellness Foundation. I attended a session yesterday where I was hearing really impressive work from the Kellogg Foundation. So I want to say that I'm going to share with you kind of our approach of our coalition in California, but it's part of a set of broader efforts that are underway both in California and nationally. We can boil it down to the three things that we're doing in California. Building public awareness and concern, because from our perspective, as we build public awareness and concern, results take place. Go back to Flint. Flint was ignored until the national media showed up and made this a crisis. And then every elected official, local, state, and federal, was jumping over themselves to do something about this. So clearly we need to build public awareness and concern. Two is we need to strengthen the voice of impacted communities. You all know better than me that a lot of the communities that face these health impacts that disproportionately impact their communities don't have a political voice to demand change. I will venture a guess that if that Flint health crisis happened in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, or Ann Arbor, Michigan, the town that I grew up in, we would have not had that arc of denial and dismissal that we had in Flint. And that's because the Flint community had little political power. And so we're working through grantees to strengthen the voice of these communities. That photo in the background is taken from a lobbying day from one of our central grantees, the Community Water Center. And a lot of groups, including those health foundations I mentioned, have supported the Community Water Center and other equity and EJ community-based groups in California to really build their level of sophistication and political power to make change. So number one is identifying and highlighting the problem. Number two is really building the political movement to make change. And it's important to note that these groups are now in league with a broader set of constituents. So it's not just an EJ issue. It's not just an equity issue. We're bringing business leaders to the table. We're bringing academic leaders to the table. We're bringing progressive local leaders to the table and really creating a coalition demanding change. And then number three is driving the policy solutions, right? Because this is a big problem, but we need solutions. And what's interesting about this is there are not one-size-fits-all approaches to this. Those examples that I showed you in different communities across the U.S., that contaminated water has manifested differently. And so in California, we're working in a place-based way to address problems as they exist in places like Monson. We're also working statewide to make it easier to consolidate very small pore systems with larger systems, like East Porterville, going into Porterville. And importantly, it's a funding issue. The fact is we have outdated water infrastructure in this country. You've probably heard about lead service line replacement in Flint and other places, terribly expensive. We have these orphaned water systems, we call them in California, those red stars on the California map that understand that they have contaminated water, but they're so small and their residents are so poor, they don't have the capital to invest in very straight ahead technology to treat the water. So in California, we're working through our grantees and supporting our grantees to essentially establish a statewide clean drinking water fund to actually ensure that all water systems can actually pursue treatment. One exciting example of this work is a media partnership that was funded by several foundations with a platform called Water Deeply in California, online platform that goes really substantively into issues. And our foundations actually funded Water Deeply to essentially become motivated and investigative journalists to really unpack this issue and then advocate these stories or work through these stories being distributed through mainstream newspapers. And the benefit of this is journalists are far more eloquent than people like me could be. And so I just want to read you an excerpt of the introduction to the series called Toxic Taps. California's five-year drought regularly made headlines across the country and even the world as thousands of wells went dry. But a lack of water is not the only problem, nor the most serious these days. The state's estimated that there are more than 300 communities recently out of compliance with safe drinking water standards. And these numbers don't take into account the thousands of people that rely on private wells. Communities with unsafe water can be found all over the state, but we're focusing on the Central Valley in this series. We meet families who've had to choose between buying shoes for their kids or buying bottled water, and others who spend their food stamps to buy safe drinking water that they are lacking at home. We talk to health experts about the risks of nitrate, arsenic, pesticides, carcinogen, and we visit communities struggling to pay for water treatment systems and water system operators stretching their resources to dozens of communities. So this is just an example of when philanthropy comes together and is creative working with its grantees that we can take new approaches in California. And those are paying off. This is one of my favorite photographs I've laid eyes on in the last year. And these are residents of East Porterville. Because after all of that media attention, ultimately, along with community advocacy, motivated local and state officials to work together, that unincorporated poor community of East Porterville was essentially connected into the public water system in Porterville. This was a completely obvious solution. The barriers that existed were money, power, race, etc. And this is one example of progress that we can make. So that leads me to really talking about what people in this room can do on water and health. And I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of foundations that I've learned about here this week that are doing a lot on this. But I can guarantee you that more needs to be done. Importantly, if you're a place-based funder in this room, recognize that drinking water quality and its problems and its solutions are inherently place-based. There is not a silver bullet solution. It's not a question of simply federal policy or simply federal funding. No doubt there's a federal and sort of state level of focus, but these have to be resolved community by community, state by state. And so the two requests or suggestions I would humbly make to you is, if you don't already know, find out what's happening in your backyard, in the community or the areas that your foundation serves. And don't assume that if you haven't read about it in the paper, it doesn't exist. Because what I've found in my own education is a lot like that situation in Ranger, Texas, where the communities aren't even aware and the public water agencies have either not been testing or have not made testing public. So my request to you is dig in a little bit and really understand what's happening in your communities and ask your grantees. And if you're an equity funder, my guess is that your grantees may be aware of water, but if water is not part of your foundation priorities, they're not talking to you about it. So ask about that. And then second is become part of a conversation that GIH and one of its equivalents in the West has started. GIH is in partnership with the Water Funder Initiative, which is a group of funders that have come together to really transform water in the West. And this year is identified as the year of partnership and focus on water and drinking water. And so the GIH staff I've talked to is really interested to know how can we build this connection between those environmental funders that are focused on water and the health funders. Because what we're experiencing is sometimes the environmental funders think that drinking water is addressed by the health funders because they think about it in a health frame. And sometimes health funders think that drinking water is addressed by environmental funders because that's the lion's share of philanthropy into water. And so GIH is really focused and interested in trying to build engagement of health funders in this question and really understand where synergies exist. An organization represented this week called HEFN, or the Health Environmental Funders Network, has been doing this work on environmental health for some time. And I believe in November, we'll be holding a discussion in Detroit on climate and health with a water dimension. So there are any number of ways to plug in. But ultimately, my message to you here is, if you're committed to health outcomes for the communities that you serve, make sure that water is a part of your work. And if your community and your communities you serve currently have clean and safe drinking water, make sure that that testing continues to occur, because this is not a static situation. So I leave you with that, and I thank everybody for your work and look forward to more success stories like East Porterville in times to come. And with that, we have an opportunity to have a little bit of a dialogue with questions and thoughts from the audience.
Hello. My name is Deborah McKenzie, and full disclosure, I live in Fresno, California, and I'm married to a hydrogeologist that works for the state. One of the things that I've heard here at the conference is about how you frame your messaging when meeting and developing partnerships. And so thinking about how framing messages that I'm giving when I'm trying to build partnerships, what message would you see me presenting if I'm talking to folks from the ag community who don't necessarily view addressing water issues the same way that we might in philanthropy?
It's an excellent question. In California, agricultural interests sort of influence water policy in the state. So any solution on drinking water actually has to bring them to the table. Ag producers, farmers, they don't want to contaminate the water. And frankly, despite there being a power and economic difference between the people that own the farms and people that work there, you know, they don't want to go to bed at night thinking that their farming production is poisoning their workers. The challenge is they feel a bit cornered because they're using fertilizer, again, this nitrogen-based fertilizer to produce food on very low margins, and they want to figure out a solution where they can continue to farm, but we can clean up the water. So we talk about it as really finding common solutions. And so in California right now, there's a remarkable sort of negotiation and agreement between environmental justice groups and agricultural groups, whereby this funding mechanism that's being discussed in Sacramento, the state's capital right now, includes a portion, about $40 million a year, that agriculture will contribute to the Clean Drinking Water Fund through a fee on fertilizer and a fee on dairies, because manure is a big issue too from the feedlots. And in exchange for that, if individual farmers are abiding the state's general orders, the rules on fertilizer use, and they're paying into that fund, they will not be subject to enforcement as long as they're abiding the rules and paying into the funds in this growing individualized enforcement. There's all sorts of details, and I don't want people to leave thinking that this deal lets agriculture off the hook. It doesn't. But it's really trying to find that common solution. Because in California, and probably a lot of places that are impacted by rural pollution, this can't be equity groups versus farmers. Not only is it not a durable solution, it probably never becomes the solution because the agricultural folks have more power in the political decision making. It doesn't mean that we shy away from the issues around what agriculture needs to contribute, but it has to be a common solution.
Thank you for a very enlightening presentation. I don't know if you can see me. I'm way back here in the back left. I am really curious about the future. In a lot of areas, we've been able to leapfrog problems through technology. So I was curious as to whether you see anything, you're investing in anything with regard to technological solutions, smaller scale filtration and things like that, that could address this need. I know folks in California are doing a lot of work on desalination, things like that. And then I was also curious about some of the market factors that also influence the poor state of our water infrastructure. We don't spend what it really costs to have clean water, and we take it for granted that even ideas around gray water usage as opposed to that we could use to water our plants. Can you talk a little bit about the market and technology and how that might be part of the solution?
Yeah, great questions. I'll take the second one first. I talk about the water problem as being 19th century laws and 20th century infrastructure for a 21st century problem. And those 19th century laws, water rights, really presume that water is a free, limitless commodity. And so we have never priced water accurately to capture ultimately what needs to be done to ensure that water is clean. But it's really challenging because, of course, water is one of those fundamental building blocks of life. And so the idea of major increases in water bills is problematic, particularly in poor communities. In California, we're working to essentially change the framework and work with water agencies so they can develop rate structures that actually build in funding for capital improvements over time. The big urban water agencies that a lot of us get our water from already do that. Your rates are terribly complicated and sophisticated and really call for that updating of infrastructure. The small systems, not so much. So really working with water agencies to do that. A big problem, I think, in a lot of places in the country is just how decentralized water is. In California, we have 7,000 water agencies. 85% of the state gets their water from 400 agencies, but the other 15 get them from essentially 6,600. Math was not my strong suit. Agencies. So therefore, we need to really focus on consolidation. With consolidation comes a broader rate base that you can actually capitalize investments in. So that's part of the solution. On technology, what's remarkable about this problem is this is not terribly expensive technology. I went out to dinner last night with an old friend I went to college with, and he has a reverse osmosis system in his own home because he's concerned about the quality of well water 20 miles west of Boston. I think this is less of a kind of a technology breakthrough and really more of a technology implementation. I think one area that's really interesting and promising, and one of our funding partners, the Pisces Foundation, is investing in this, is citizen science. How do you use technology to empower communities to actually monitor their own air and their own water? And in some cases, that's been used very effectively to ultimately embarrass the local authorities into doing something. Lead testing, for example, is actually relatively expensive. So are there ways to essentially democratize the testing of water and uploading onto a common platform? This may be active in initiatives across the country, but that's one idea off the top of my head.
Earl Dewey, California Wellness Foundation. So Wade, thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. You know, water and water policy issues seem so technical at times and often political, as you've talked about. So do you have any advice for foundations who are, you know, want to learn or get more active on water? And, you know, how do they, excuse the pun, wade into those sort of technical and public policy and political issues?
Yeah. Well, first, I would say that actually clean water is a bipartisan or a nonpartisan issue. If you look at polling across the country, Everybody wants clean water. And when you look at like congressional discussions around investments for lead line replacements, it's remarkably bipartisan. So I would first of all say to, you know, health foundations that are not political, don't be scared of the discussion around clean drinking water, because it actually has broad consensus in terms of local, state, and federal leadership. That's not to say that it can't manifest in political ways, and you obviously have to take care for that. So that's number one. Number two is, in terms of how do foundations even begin to do this work, I would not be intimidated by, you know, what can seem like the technical aspects of drinking water quality. There are numerous objective resources around this question around whether water systems are meeting their quality standards. It starts by talking to grantees about this. Are grantees hearing that there are concerns or problems? Talking with local leaders that are experts on water, academic institutions, research institutions, even talking with water agencies. Although, you know, I don't want to make water agencies the adversary, but I think that there needs to be deeper assessment than just going to the authorities on water. Allison, staff of GIH, had a good suggestion, which is if there is interest among health funders in figuring out how to even dip a toe into this question of water and health in your own community, GIH, I don't think I'm volunteering them for this, but maybe I am, is interested in developing webinars, seminars, et cetera, to actually start to unpack this. I would consider, you know, my talk wildly successful if at least some foundations that hadn't been thinking about water start to think about water. And I know the Water Foundation, GIH, this partnership with the Water Funder Initiative, and HEFIN would be really interested in facilitating that conversation.
Wade, one of the interesting things about drinking water and drinking water standards are changing technology and different regulatory levels. For example, there was an arsenic standard. I think it was actually a high school student discovered how to detect levels of arsenic 10 times lower than the current ability. And so the standard was reset 10 times lower. And suddenly there were water supplies across Colorado that were no longer in compliance. The same thing happened with uranium, which interestingly enough wasn't because of radiation, but because of heavy metal poisoning in the kidneys. And we have Eastern Plain drinking water sources that overnight became hazardous. So how do we message and keep up with the kind of changing standards and our technical ability to detect kind of contaminants in water, especially if you're a headwater state that has a history of mining, which generates only bad things?
Well, that's a great question, and probably one I won't sufficiently answer. I would acknowledge that while we shouldn't be intimidated by the complexity of some of the science, it is sometimes complex. And you're right that there are changing standards as technology develops. And there are water agencies that may throw up their hands and say, I abided this limit, but then you've now changed it and I'm out of compliance. Well, fair enough. There needs to be an adjustment there. I think it would be helpful for some platform that helps translate all of these questions to foundations, to policymakers, et cetera, and some sort of objective platform that helped us understand these issues. Because if it's a high-level question between a state or federal regulator and a water agency, most of us are left out of discussion. So I, for one, would like to see, as we're evolving standards, really understanding what the practical impact of those standards are so that our grantees can figure in if it's something that's meaningful or decide that it's not something to focus on if it's not meaningful. It's a good question, though.
Talked a lot about what you do with the water you have, and I want to know what you think about the water you don't have, which is the water that's come out of the aquifers, which is not going to be replenished any time in the near future, and the serious shortages based on current usage that exist Midwest, West, whatever.
It's an excellent question. So a lot of places in the country depend on underground water that they pump from the ground. And essentially, this water has developed over millennia. There is a natural cycle where the rain falls, the snow falls, percolates down to the groundwater, into the groundwater aquifers. But the challenge has been that the rate of pumping has vastly outstripped the rate of replenishment. So as the gentleman mentions, we have situations in this country and in places like California where literally the ground is sinking. It's called subsidence, because the water is drained from the underground aquifer and the soil compacts. And even in a big city like Houston, has had to depopulate some of its neighborhoods right along the coast because the ground has sank as a result of subsidence and coastal inundation is a major threat. Part of this is moving towards sustainable management of groundwater. California was the last state in the West to even manage groundwater. Before 2 years ago, you could literally buy a patch of dirt anywhere in California, stick as many wells as you wanted in the backyard as deep as possible, and pump to your heart's content, which is not feasible. So part of it is getting us to a sustainable yield of groundwater. But then two is taking advantage of the water that we do have. I mean, let me advance a radical concept, which is it's a complete waste that we flush our toilets with drinking water, right? I always like to say, I surprise people in California because I say, we have enough water in California if we actually use it correctly. And if you go to a place like Australia or Israel that has had real water shortages sustained over time, those places are super efficient with their water. You may not know that the city of Las Vegas literally recycles almost 100% of its indoor water use. So next time you're in Las Vegas and you see the big fountain at the Venetian, don't feel too guilty. You're in the middle of the desert because that water is at least recycled. But water recycling is one. The other is stormwater capture, which is a big problem. Most cities that we live in are concerned with complying with the Federal Clean Water Act because when it rains, that rain takes all of these contaminants on our streets and flushes them into pipes. In a place like LA we work, those pipes go through poor neighborhoods or those open canals go through poor neighborhoods and into the ocean. So how about capturing that stormwater where we actually reduce the amount of polluted runoff and take that stormwater and put it in underground aquifers? In Los Angeles, LA County has 10 million people. It would be the 11th most populous state in the country. Huge. And mostly concrete, if you've ever flown into Los Angeles. At the same time, it imports 85% of its water from different distant rivers that are overtaxed. So imagine if LA County actually made an ongoing major investment in stormwater capture to not only reduce the pollution and the runoff that has essentially cities paying millions of dollars for Clean Water Act violations, but instead capture that water and put it in underground aquifers and reduce the dependence on these distant overtaxed rivers, right? So to your question, remarkably on water, water has lagged in terms of innovation. If you look at things like energy and technology, where that have really come a long way in terms of incorporating technology and becoming more efficient. Water, again, those 19th century laws, that 20th century infrastructure. So I think that there's a lot of energy and potential innovation on known solutions. It's just a matter of building awareness and political will on the central importance of water, not only to our health, our lives, but our economy too.
I'm from Maine, Lisa Miller, Bingham Program Small Foundation. You're a Western-oriented foundation and your issues are Western. I grew up in California. I know all about those battles. But we're starting to have these battles in Maine. We have a lot of water, but half our population drinks its water from their own personal wells. We don't have a lot of water agencies. We have lousy county structures. But we're starting to have these fights about who owns that water. When Poland Spring and Nestle come in and set up good economic development opportunities for rural towns, but are sucking tons of water out of our water table. Are you negotiating at all these kinds of discussions about ownership of this resource?
I would say yes, but I can't give you any ready-made solutions. This is sort of the tragedy of the commons, which is if you have a common asset, ultimately, if you don't manage it, it can be over-allocated. And these bottled water companies, essentially pumping water almost for free from groundwater basins and then turning around and it's like a gigantic multi-billion dollar industry. So yes, we are having these conversations. And really, ultimately, what we've done in California, we're focused on localizing the management of the groundwater basin. So what we said is, we're going to give local entities or local communities the opportunity to manage a groundwater basin. That is, create a management agency, identify the slice of pie that you can sustainably pump every year, and then divide that slice of pie. Super tough issue because people are used to this as a property right. But the idea is empower the local communities to do it themselves. And oh, by the way, if they don't, the big bad state's going to come in and do it for them. So there are models of groundwater management that we in California learned from in other states, not just Western states, that perhaps Maine could as well. I'm getting the hook on this monitor, so let's do just a quick question and answer. You both ask them and then I'll answer quickly.
Okay, I'm from Texas, and fracking is big business there and has major implications for groundwater. So I'm just curious, have you ever reached out to companies like Halliburton? And if so, what happened?
Great question. And then just so I can answer them quickly, is there another question in back?
Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. 60% of low-income residents of Philadelphia are behind on their water bills. They can't get government jobs, and sometimes even their children can be taken away from them if they don't have water service from Child Protective Services. How do we make sure that as we improve water systems, that there isn't a disproportionate burden on low-income water consumers?
Excellent question. So on fracking, you know, you may know that essentially oil and gas shale production requires putting a bunch of chemicals, oftentimes not publicly disclosed, under the ground to essentially bring up the gas. And a lot of those chemicals impact human health. There's a growing movement, probably supported by some in this room, around really looking into the human health impacts of that fracking water. We have not had direct conversations with the Halliburtons or the large gas producers in the world, but there's an active movement in California on fracking. I worked for 5 years in the state government, and I think in state government, there's a question of to frack or not to frack, but I think that there's also an important question to say that likely will be fracking in this country for a lot of reasons. The question is, how does it happen in as safe a way as possible? So in California, there was an effort to really strengthen safety laws on water. Maybe insufficient, but that's one avenue. And then an excellent question on affordability. We didn't even touch on affordability today. I really wanted to focus on the aspects of health and clean water. But if you're a funder that focuses on equity, know that a lot of people that get bad, unhealthy water actually have to pay for that water. And that there are residential disclosures in Flint, Michigan, because people couldn't pay the water bills for the polluted water that was coming into their homes that they weren't using. So affordability is a real problem. In California, we do not have a low-income assistance program on water. We do on electricity. In electricity, we have what's called a lifeline rate. And if you are income qualified, then you have essentially a subsidized rate of electricity. I would make an argument that if we have that for electricity, we should certainly have that for water. And we shouldn't be in a situation where people are choosing between paying the water bill and taking care of other vital needs. You saw that photo of Maria Jimenez in Monson, California, and saw the amount of bottled water that you have to buy on a daily basis. I'd venture a guess that most people in this room, when we buy a bottle of water at the airport, we don't give it a second thought, even though it's $3 or $4 or $5 at the airport. If you were doing that every day of your life, and you were in a rurally isolated area, and you weren't even getting it in large quantities, you're getting it in these small quantities, you are truly making economic choices between having healthy water and having other needs. So there's a combined effort in terms of the clean and healthy along with the affordable. And the grantees that we and the Wellness Foundation and others support in California are focused on both. They're separate political lifts, but still joined. So let me stop there and thank you very much for having me here today.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.